The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and his honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman First Class Andrew I. Lotza, miscellaneous docket number 2016-13. Today, the issue presented for oral argument is whether the military judge abused his discretion by granting the defense motion to suppress the contents of a digital copy of appellant's phone. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir, 5 minutes.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir.
Senior Judge Bennett, may it please the court. I am Captain Matt Tusing, and together with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. The Fourth Amendment was not violated here, and the military judge erred as a matter of law in determining otherwise. First, the judge held that there was a possessory interest in a forensic copy when there wasn't. Second, the judge misrepresented persuasive authority and misapplied Osorio. And finally, the military judge misapplied Dees in determining appellee had an objective privacy interest in OSI's data. So first, the military judge erred as a matter of law when he determined that OSI had seized the data, when they actually only searched and copied some of the data. Copying information is not a seizure. We looked at Arizona v. Hicks, where the officer in that case was in exigent circumstances, and he turned over the turntable and then wrote down some of the serial numbers that he saw during that search. Our Supreme Court held in that case that mere act of copying the information did not, at page 324, did not interfere with respondents' possessory interests in either the serial numbers or the equipment. And indeed, our Superior Court in Jacobs in 1990 adopted Hicks and applied it to Military Rules of Evidence 311. And in that case, determined the same, that when the shirt looked at the typewriter in plain view and recorded down the information that he saw from the serial numbers, the act of recording was not only not a seizure in that instance, it also wasn't a search. So it's established that copying information is not, in fact, a seizure. And because copying is not a seizure, the data that OSI reviewed after the OSI interview was not appellee's papers or effects. And because it wasn't his papers or effects, it wasn't protected by the Fourth Amendment. And so the search or the review of that data at a later date was not a search for Fourth Amendment purposes, and the military judge, in determining otherwise, committed his first error.
So, counsel, to make sure I understand your point, you're arguing that there was no seizure on the 24th at the interview. Is that correct?
Your Honor, we're saying there was no seizure of the data during the interview. Now, one can argue that the phone was seized momentarily, that there was meaningful interference when they had the phone together with appellee, they plugged it into the machine, and the machine did its processing. But that seizure, to the extent that there was any, if there was any, only lasted for 23 minutes.
But isn't it also your position that there was a search on the 24th during the interview, is that correct?
Yes, sir. So our position is when the machine looked at the information on the phone, it did some level of processing. And you see that in the record at attachment 7, Appellate Exhibit 7, Attachment 2, at the 1 hour and 41 minute mark, where OSI and the appellee are talking about what the machine does and does not do.
So whether there was a search or a seizure or both, either way, the Fourth Amendment is implicated, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Whether there is a search or a seizure or both a search and a seizure on the date that they extracted the data from the phone, either way, the Fourth Amendment comes into play.
Yes, sir. On the date of the OSI interview, when they were working with the phone on that day. But when appellee took his phone with its data still intact and left OSI that day, That was the end of the search or the seizure either way. The machine had to identify what files were on the phone and separate out that this file it means this and this file means that, and it did some level of processing. At that point, the machine then copied the files that Apelli consented to having been searched. So the copying process itself wasn't a seizure, but arguably the process that the machine went through was a search itself, but either way, it terminated that date of the OSI interview when they unplugged his phone and he walked out the door and left with it. So the military judge committed his first error when he determined that OSI had seized the data. And you see that in his ruling when he's talking about whether or not there was an objective privacy interest in that seized data, when in fact it was only a copy. And that's important here because the second error is when the military judge misrepresented persuasive authority and misapplied Osorio. The military judge dumped this persuasive authority in his footnote, including authority from this court, and claimed the opinions do not stand for that which they actually stand for. We look to U.S. v. Cote. He throws that in a footnote. But that case, the case on interlocutory appeal, is very instructive here. While it's not binding, it's incredibly persuasive. In that case, if you recall, the law enforcement, they seized two laptops. They were able to, within the time period of the warrant, they were able to make a forensic copy of that information. And there, this court determined that, look, the appellee in that case did not have a privacy interest in the forensic copy. And they cite to Vaughn v. Baldwin. They cite to another case out of the 11th called Megahead, which stands for the proposition that one does not have an objective privacy interest in a copy made by law enforcement.
Counsel, the Cote case involved a search warrant, right?
Yes, sir.
Not consent.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Is there a difference?
There's not a difference in this case. If the search is performed within the authority that the search is grounded in, that's why Hicks applies here. That was an exigent circumstances case. The search, as long as the search is valid, it doesn't matter what the basis of the search is for this court's analysis. The point in Cote in the legal question this court is grappling with here today is whether or not that privacy interest was violated when they looked at a copy of their own information.
In Cote, though, there were limitations on the search warrant, right? There was a 90-day limitation.
There was a limitation, and this court specifically said, look, the copy was made within that time period. So because it was validly pulled as part of that original basis for the authorization, whether that be consent or warrant, because that copy was made within the acceptable search parameters, there was no privacy interest there that was permissible. It's interesting to note the follow-on for that case is also helpful because that case was sent back down. He was actually acquitted of that information, he was acquitted of the charges that stemmed from the laptop mirrored images. But he was convicted of other information that was drawn from an external hard drive, which OSI was not able to create a forensic image of within that 90 days. In fact, it took them almost a year later. In that case, our Superior Court held, look, that was well outside the established parameters of the original search, so the copy wasn't permitted. It wasn't permissible to make that copy after that point. The military judge erred by, misstating Cote's persuasiveness, but also every court or every case that the judge cited in his footnote, he did the same. Mason v. Pulliam out of the 5th, Ward out of the 9th, Megahead, Sharp. Those are all cases that do stand for the proposition that one does not have a privacy interest in a copy. The military judge took it a little bit further, and he misconstrued Vaughn v. Baldwin absolutely. And Vaughn v. Baldwin was the case that this court had previously relied upon in Cote. And Vaughn v. Baldwin, the military judge, in his footnote, stated that the holding in Vaughn is that the IRS had a right to make a copy of papers voluntarily given over by the defendant pursuant to an investigation, but the IRS could no longer possess those copies once defendant withdrew consent. That is not the holding in Vaughn. In Vaughn, Vaughn was a person, but for the purposes of that case, was considered a corporation. And Baldwin was the IRS agent. And Vaughn handed over a treasure trove of documents, financial records, et cetera, and Baldwin refused to give them back. The court permitted him to keep the records that he made prior to the revocation of consent in that case. If you look to the Vaughn holding at page 333 and 334, the court in that case said it's clear that the IRS was entitled to copy the records while it was in lawful possession. So the military judge erred, misconstruing what Vaughn meant in addition to all of those cases. And then the military judge misapplied Osorio, or the relevant holding in Osorio. The relevant holding in Osorio is on page 639 of that opinion, where this court held that consent in that case was limited to searching the original drive for pictures from one particular date and not a general search of the external hard drive. In that case, the appellant had given OSI the entire hard drive and told them, hey, I only consent to pictures from 12 February. But when they went in, they looked at other pictures, and the court in that case determined that his rights were violated because that was outside the scope of his authorization to begin with. Osorio doesn't stand for the proposition that somebody has a privacy interest in any copy whatsoever. It's got to stem from the authorization originally granted. That's all that Osorio stands for. But the military judge erred by laying that foundation of misapplication of Osorio and that persuasive authority when he made his third error of law, which was misapplying Deese completely in determining that Appellee had an objective privacy interest in OSI's data. The military judge stated that when Appellee revoked his consent, that OSI had already seized the data after the revocation of consent. They'd already seized it, but as noted earlier, copying is not a seizure, so that was an error in law. Deese is about a possessory interest. The holding in Deese is that consent does not equal abandonment of one's urine. Consenting to hand over your urine is not the equivalent of abandoning one's urine. And in that case, this court determined that Deese didn't have any Fourth Amendment protections in his urine because he essentially threw his urine away. It was of such negligible value that he released it to authorities. He had no interest in it at that point because it was like throwing out his garbage. And they cited California v. Greenwood, which allows law enforcement to reduce somebody's garbage because they essentially throw it away. Our superior court had to make a determination that he did not throw out his property, his possessory interest, in order to arrive to the conclusion that they didn't Deese. A possessory or trespassory doctrine idea of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence was met in the Deese opinion because they had to say, look, the urine, although it was negligible intrinsic value, there was value nonetheless. He still owned a piece of his own body there. So his Fourth Amendment rights travel with his urine to Brooks Laboratory. But what the military judge and appellee asks this court to do is to forget possessory interest in a Fourth Amendment analysis and only apply a nature and evidentiary test, a piece of Deese. What the judge is asking us all to do is to look and say, look, the evidentiary value of the text messages at the time of the search was unknown, and its nature, the judge points to Riley and says, hey, the nature of it is so great, and nobody, knew what the texts were worth at the time of the copying, then therefore one has a privacy interest in a copy. That is a misapplication of the law. The piece of Deese, the evidentiary value and nature test, spoke to whether or not somebody still had a possessory interest in their urine, not whether in isolation, just the value of the information alone or the nature of it created the privacy interest. Let's speak first to the evidentiary value, this idea that, you know, because at the time that the copying was done, nobody knew what the text said, or law enforcement didn't, and so therefore that created a privacy interest. That's not what Deese stood for. In Deese, nobody knew what the urine would tell. It took a chemical analysis by some machinery to determine what the evidentiary value was. That is not the case here. These are text messages. One does not need a special piece of equipment to flip through the text messages to see what their value is. And indeed, the appellee in this case understood what his text messages were. He drafted them, he wrote them, he could easily review them and see them. So he knew what the evidentiary value was when he agreed to allow law enforcement to copy it.
But counsel, doesn't the language in Deese specifically compare the bodily fluids to computer hard drives? In other words, I think there's language that suggests that they are the same for these purposes.
Yes, sir. You're speaking of the reference to the Wallace case. Yes, sir. So Wallace stands for only the proposition that a search and a seizure may not be coterminous, meaning it might not happen at the same time. So in Wallace, they seized the hard drive and then shipped it off somewhere, and then the forensic analysis was done later. That's what Deese relies upon. It was like, look, see, it doesn't have to happen at the same time. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. And in Wallace, you know, the urine was like the hard drive in Wallace, and that the search and the seizure wasn't done at the same time. That's what Wallace stands for. Wallace doesn't stand for the idea that there's a privacy interest in copies. It stands for the idea that the search might be done later. The analog to this case, Your Honor, is the search and the seizure was done coterminously, to the extent that there was any seizure at all, on the day of the OSI interview. He walked out of OSI with his property, with his stuff. So Wallace isn't Wallace doesn't direct this court or any court that a privacy interest exists in any sort of a copy. It's used by Deese just to say, look, urine is like a computer hard drive in this particular instance. Because in Deese, the government was arguing that the search and seizure happened when they took his urine. That happened coterminously. So the court used Wallace to say, look, sometimes it doesn't happen coterminously. And that's the extent of Wallace.
So, counsel, if I understand your argument, and correct me if I'm misstating it or missummarizing it, you're saying this case is unlike Deese because Deese didn't know what the result of the urinalysis would be in the way that Cote knew what the content of his text messages is. Is that fair?
That is one of three reasons why Deese doesn't apply here. Okay. Yes, sir.
But wouldn't Deese have had an idea as to what a urinalysis would find based on his knowledge of what he had been imbibing and using?
The question isn't whether Deese understood what he had been doing. The question is whether Deese knew what his urine would expose. But I'm glad you asked that question, sir, because to interpret evidentiary value from just whether or not that the privacy interest travels only to the extent that the evidentiary value is known would lead us, if that's the position and how you read these, it would lead us to a ridiculous result. What if OSI, during the interview in this case, had actually taken photos of the text messages on the phone but hadn't read them yet? And then the appellee leaves with his phone and texts in hand. Does the appellee have a privacy interest, any interest at all in the photos that they took of his text messages? Does he have an interest in the camera? If the camera's got some sort of memory chip in it, they'd have to hand the camera back over. If you just pull out this isolated, you know, evidentiary value piece, what happens if law enforcement reviews the text but they don't understand the evidentiary value until much later? Are they precluded from testifying to it because they didn't understand the value of what they read until after appellee revoked consent? What about pictures of pictures? I mean, it leads to a result that is far beyond the horizon in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. Deese is different because Deese had a possessory interest in his own bodily fluids that went out the door. The copy is the distinction that makes the difference here. So it's the copying process, it's the evidentiary value issue, but it's also the machine, it's what the machine did in Deese. The court held in Deese that, you know, the search happened, you know, when it went to Brooks' lab. You know, the natural inference there is when they put the urine in the machine and it, you know, beep, boop, did its process and then outputted a report, that information, that copying, that analysis happened. What if in Deese he didn't revoke consent until after the machine had done its part at Brooks, right? We'd lead to a different result because the evidentiary value would be there. I mean, there'd be reports, there'd be information to be able to see it. The UFED machine in our case is like the machine at Brooks, right? That process, that forensic tool was being used by law enforcement on the 24th of March, 2016. And when, just because OSI didn't look at the results of that till later, it doesn't place a privacy interest on the copies or the notes or anything that OSI did with that data later. So there are three reasons. The evidentiary value it doesn't alone establish a privacy right in a copy. The nature of the urine in Deese is completely different than the copy here, right? And one final note, Judge Johnson, about Deese and this evidentiary value idea and this nature idea. The court in Deese pointed to Skinner to establish that one still has a possessory privacy interest in one's bodily fluid because it stems from the person of the Fourth Amendment, you know, securing his persons. And just because the fluid leaves the body, they still have an interest. But if you look to Skinner, the Supreme Court in Skinner compares and makes a distinction between that, and they cite Hicks, the case we started this conversation with. They look at it and they say, look, urine is different than what happened in Hicks, where the law enforcement just looked at the serial numbers and then copied it. It's a different thing. Your rights are a little bit different when it comes to your urine. And so Deese is distinct from this situation for those reasons as well. So the military judge erred in three ways. He made an erroneous conclusion of law when he says he had seized the data, when OSI had seized the data, when they actually only searched it, processed it, and made a copy of some of the data. The judge then erred when saying that this persuasive authority in Osorio sets up this idea that there's a privacy interest in a copy. And then they misapplied Deese, which Deese does not stand for the proposition that a privacy interest follows no matter what copy or information OSI receives during a consent search. It's more limited to a possessory interest in one's urine, which doesn't exist here. It's important to note that the analysis doesn't end there. We still look to Katz, we still look to U.S. v. Jones to determine whether any of those cases or any of that precedent establishes a privacy interest here. And I'll note before I wrap up that Katz does not create a privacy interest in a forensic copy here because the appellee knowingly exposed that information to law enforcement. The analog to this case in Katz is if Katz had invited the officers into his phone booth and invited them to listen in the entire conversation, and they took notes and recorded what happened and walked out. Justice Stewart in that case would certainly have determined that Katz knowingly exposed those conversations to whatever OSI wanted to do with it. So for those reasons, the three errors in law that form the basis of the military judge's opinion, the United States asks that you vacate that decision because the Fourth Amendment was not violated in this case. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, unless there are any other questions.
No more questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appellant's counsel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Honorable members of this court, may it please the court. I am Captain Patricia Encarnacion Miranda, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Jeffrey Palomino, we represent Airman First Class Andrew Lotsa in this case. The military judge did not abuse his discretion. His findings of fact are supported by the record and are not clearly erroneous. He also applied the law correctly. In answering the question before this court today, you must review the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party at trial. The standard this court has to apply today calls for more than a mere difference of opinion. The military judge's challenge action must be arbitrary, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous for this court to find an abuse of discretion. First, I will address why the military judge correctly concluded that appellee had a privacy interest in the contents of his phone based on the Supreme Court decision in Riley versus California and the Court of Appeals decision in United States versus Deese. Riley versus California establishes a privacy interest in the information. And I think that's an important distinction here because government counsel is arguing that because the information was not in his phone anymore and was somewhere else, it's not entitled to the Fourth Amendment protection. And Riley disagrees with that.
Counsel, what about his analogy to actually taking a photograph of the data?
There is a big difference with that analogy because the difference about taking a photograph of the data is that the information has already been searched. It has been exposed to human observation, and at that point is known. The difference in this case is while the information sits electronically stored in the device used for the extraction, until it's taken out of the device with the use of a USB, plugged into the standalone computer, as the agent testified in this case, and then run a separate report or generate a conversation view, I think it's what the agent refers to it in his testimony, he has no idea what's sitting in the device. So I think that's the big difference with the example that the government presented. In arriving to the privacy interest in the information established in Riley, the court emphasized that the reason why the Fourth Amendment goes to protect the information is because phones today are like mini computers. It's because the data a user views on a cell phone may not be in fact stored on the cell phone. It could be in a server, it could be in applications, it could be in the cloud, I think they mentioned in the opinion. And based on the numerous ways in how digital media works today, they concluded that the Fourth Amendment has to protect the information that the officers obtain when they extract information from a phone. And the judge Chief Justice Roberts at page 2496 says that the fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand doesn't make the information any less worthy of the protection for the which the founders fought.
But didn't your client consent to law enforcement copying that information?
Correct, Your Honor.
But he left with his phone.
Correct.
And all that information intact, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So really, does that expectation of privacy extend to that copy?
Yes, Your Honor. And
so he maintains a possessory interest in the copy that OSI made of that information, of that data?
Yes, Your Honor. And I will get to that. I can go to that point right now. So in line with Riley's decision about the Fourth Amendment protection, the information, I would say the answer to your question is more in line with the holding in United States versus Deese. And I'll go directly to page 121 in Deese. And this is in relation to when the court is discussing MRE 314E3, establishing the continued privacy interest in the evidence that you give law enforcement. And the site that I'm referring to at Deese, it says, MRE 314E3, by codifying a right to revoke consent when viewed in light of the separate privacy interest laid out by the Supreme Court in Skinner, which we talked about that with the government, implies a continued privacy interest maintained by appellant in the untested urine sample. Later in the paragraph, it continues by saying, the MRE, by allowing the withdrawal of consent, is not intended to allow a service member to reclaim abandoned property, but rather than to protect a privacy interest. So it would be the same in the context of Dees, that saying by Dees consenting for OSI to take his urine, and he left the building without the urine, he loses the privacy interest. And that's not what the court concluded in United States versus Dees. So another, I'm going to go back to Riley if there are no further questions on Dees. Another way that Riley is important in this case is because it compares the searches and seizures of digital evidence to other type of evidence. And the government cited examples at the trial level and here about searches involving papers and tax documents and other types of physical evidence. And Riley says that's no, most of these cases are no longer applicable when we're talking about digital evidence. And the government in Riley tried to present the same type of argument, and they said, I'm quoting from Riley, the United States asserts that a search of data stored on a phone is materially indistinguishable from searches of the source of physical items. And Chief Judge Roberts says to that, that is like saying a ride on a horseback is materially indistinguishable from a flight to the moon. And after that statement, it goes into discussing why we can't compare digital evidence searches and why we can't use most of these Fourth Amendment cases that we have in applying them to digital evidence. And at page 2489, it talks about why we can't compare it to wallets, purses, cigarette packs, papers. And page 2491, it talks about why we can't compare it to house searches and containers. So I think it is important to know that the Supreme Court, it's telling us, like, they're ignoring their own precedent. In that case, in Robinson, which was arguably applicable to the case that they were deciding, saying that we have all these cases that we have decided before regarding how the Fourth Amendment apply in different situations. But most of them, we can't apply in the digital evidence world, and they go on explaining why.
Well, counsel, so Cote dealt with digital evidence, correct?
Correct, sir.
So, and is there, do you see any way that the position that you're advocating right now is compatible with the panel decision in Cote?
I think the biggest difference, and I go back to the question that Judge Bennett posed to the government, is that in Cote we're talking about a warrant search. So the media seized in Cote was obtained pursuant to a warrant. If the government comes to take evidence from me, whatever that evidence is, assuming, let's say that they come take my phone and they show me a warrant, I have no expectation, reasonable expectation, to be able to tell law enforcement, you can't search this evidence that you're taking pursuant to a warrant, because the expectation of privacy is different.
So you're saying there's a different expectation of privacy in your data depending on whether you're presented with a warrant or whether you're consenting to the view of the information?
I think the privacy interest is still the same, but I think you can't treat warrant searches the same as consent searches based on what Dees tells us.
But they're both lawful.
They're both lawful.
And the data,
correct, sir,
in this case was lawfully, was it lawfully copied?
It was lawfully copied, lawfully obtained, lawfully whatever word we want to use. It was in OSI's possession in a lawful manner.
So if it's in OSI's possession, through the consent of LOTSA, correct?
Correct, sir.
What privacy interest then does he, reasonable expectation of privacy, does he have in that copy now possessed by Air Force OSI?
And I go back to the Dees decision where it says that you don't lose your privacy interest over the evidence when you give it to OSI, and until the search is complete, is the language that's used in there, you still retain the right to revoke consent over to search or over evidence that you gave.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose, let's go back to D, suppose they had run your analysis before consent was revoked. How is that different?
The search is complete.
So the distinction is when they, in this case, when they actually go and look at the data they extracted, that's a search, which exceeds the scope of the consent, is what you're saying.
Sir, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
So when they actually go and look at the data that they extracted in this case, that is a search that exceeds the scope of the consent. Is that the point that you're making?
No, I guess my point to that would be if the OSI agents in our case would have looked at the contents of the phone before he revoked consent, we wouldn't be here.
All right, and sorry, I should have phrased that better, but yes, that was the point that I was trying to get to.
Yes, sir. At that point, is viewed, is searched, and he has no right to revoke consent anymore. Because the information is known at that point. I apologize, sir.
So it doesn't matter whether it could have been viewed, it's whether it's actually viewed.
Correct.
So to use the photo analogy, if they had taken photos of the phone, but they hadn't looked at them until after consent was revoked, then that would also be suppressed.
I don't agree with that because by taking the photo of the phone, you are exposed to the content. So at least they're exposed to human observation. They're exposed to a preliminary search. The content is known at that point.
Well, counsel, you have a folder. Say law enforcement and you're the subject of an investigation. You say, well, here, you can look. I have this ledgers and all this handwritten documents, part of it, diaries, like I said, ledgers, all this stuff. You can copy pages 10 through 12 and then 20 through the end of it. I walk back to the administrative section, run them through the copier, give it back to you, throw those copies on my desk. And they sit on my desk for a few weeks. Within that time, you revoke your consent. You're saying I can't go back and look at those copies. I can't go back and conduct handwriting analysis on the handwritten notes that you provided me, the copies that I made with your consent.
It's hard to try to work with these examples because they're very different from digital media. But if you obtain the copies lawfully, then the seizure of these copies was lawful. If you search them before the revocation of consent, then the search is lawful. If the revocation of consent occurs before they've been searched, then the search has to stop. If those documents that we're talking about were obtained pursuant to a consent authorization, pursuant to MRE 314E3. Does that answer your question, sir?
It does, thank you. Okay.
So I would like to address these if I'm going to move from Riley. I understand the government disagrees with the judge's application and the judge's interpretation of these, but I will remind the court of the stand that a mere difference of opinion does not result in an abuse of discretion. I would like to point out four reasons, and we've discussed some of it, why the judge correctly concluded that United States versus Dees is applicable to this case. One, we discussed, it talks about this two-step process, and the search and the seizures are not necessarily coterminous, and we discussed that in this case. I'm not going to go any further with that. The nature of the evidence. I understand that the government wants to make a distinction. Urine is different than digital evidence, and I agree. And the court of appeals for the armed forces also identify that, and they went out of their way in a urine case to point out in page 121 that this is akin to that of a computer hard drive whose evidentiary value is unknown until it is examined. And that is the situation that we have here today. So it was reasonable for the judge, and that was the state of the law that the judge had to decide in this case, and he correctly applied it when he made his decision. The seizure and search of a computer hard drive constitutes two separate and distinct intrusions into privacy interests, which is the same situation that we have here today. We haven't talked a lot about MRE 314E3, and I believe that is a big difference that we have in this case. We have a codified MRE that allows a service member to do exactly what my client did in this case. And that is a big difference that is not applied in some of the cases that the government presented at the trial level to the military judge, in some of the cases they're presenting here today, which I'm going to address shortly. But the Court of Appeal for the Armed Forces explained in their opinion that by codifying this right to revoke consent, when viewed in light of the separate privacy interest, it implies a continued privacy interest maintained by appellant in the untested urine sample, in our case, in the unexamined contents of the phone. Another point that I'm going to make about United States versus Dees, and is when they're talking about withdrawing the consent prior to the completion of the search, they add in footnote 5 and at page 121, and they explain that while the Supreme Court has not specifically ruled on the question of whether there is a continuation of a Fourth Amendment privacy interest, most of the federal courts of appeal have held that consent to search may be revoked if the person giving the consent effectively withdraws the consent prior to the completion of the search. And that is where they pull from, for lack of a better word, when deciding that you can withdraw consent at any point until the search is complete. The government at trial had the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the evidence was not obtained as a result of an unlawful search. And they had two ways of doing that, either prove there's not a privacy interest or prove that the search was completed before the revocation of consent. The cases that they presented the judge with at the trial level, Ward, Cote, Megahead, Sharp, these are all cases that not only they're not controlling, some of them deal with very different types of evidence, as it's highlighted in Riley versus California. And the other thing is, like, the cases that are not military, they also don't have a codified MRE 314E3. So they don't have to contemplate this right that is given to service members by law to withdraw consent any time before a search is complete.
Well, you would agree that the judge found that your client specifically consented to them making a copy of the data on his phone, correct?
Correct, sir. So going back to what the judge was presented with, so the judge the government presented these cases that are not in line with Supreme Court cases, with CAF cases, and with the rules of evidence, and they were asking essentially the judge to ignore these cases, the holding in these cases, and find that there's no privacy interest. And that's not reasonable. Therefore, the judge, the law, that's the state of the law as it is what the judge applied, and he applied it correctly. The other part of the first prong of the burden about proving that the evidence was not obtained in an unlawful manner is like the other alternative they had is to prove that it was searched before. Then the search was completed before he revoked consent, and they couldn't do that because of the actions of the agents that our court is already aware of. Second prong of the burden they had at trial that they also failed to meet is that the evidence would have been obtained if the unlawful search had not occurred. And we have no evidence on the record, and the government is not arguing that we're in an inevitable discovery situation. And the third part is that the evidence was obtained by officials who reasonably and with good faith relied on an authorization to search. And before I go to the good faith exception, if I'm still going to have time, I would like to address the government's argument about United States versus Jones, and it's in page 14 of their argument that the search already happened because the device, the cell phone was plugged into the device, and they're using United States versus Jones, and they have a quote in the Florida versus Hardinas at page 14-17 that they're saying that in that case, because the receiver had been physically mounted on the defendant's automobile, thus intruding into his effect, therefore the tracking was the search. And I want to point the court into the extent that the government is trying to argue that the search was complete or that the plugging of the device was the search. To Jones' case specifically, first of all, the holding is that the installation of the GPS device on the vehicle and its use of the device to monitor the movement is what's constituted a search, not the plugging in of the device. And this issue is clarified in the court's footnote number 5, where it says that the obtaining of the information alone is not a search unless it is achieved by a trespass or an invasion of privacy. And the alternative, the trespass itself is not alone unless you obtain the information. And the information in this case was not obtained or known until the agent run the search in the computer and learned what was in the phone. So even if you can argue that the search started when the phone was plugged into the device, the search was not complete until the information was known. Therefore, the withdrawal of consent was still valid. Finally, I will address the government's argument regarding the good faith exception, and they cite United States versus Peltier at page 22 and 23 of their argument. United States versus Peltier, I'll briefly touch on the facts, is a Border Patrol agent that is conducting a search pursuant to Title 8, Section 1357. The decision the court has before it in Peltier is whether to retroactively apply a subsequent decision. So at the time that the Border Patrol agent searched the vehicle pursuant to that statute was valid. A subsequent Supreme Court decision decided that the statute was going to be invalidated, and the question is whether we're going to apply this subsequent decision to that prior case. And what the judge said that the search was valid because at the time the statute was valid. And we have that same principle codified in our Emory 311C4, and we know that the judge considered it because in his decision he cites that basically his finding after conducting all the analysis, the court finds that Emory requires that the evidence be suppressed. So we know that the judge is aware of these cases that the government is bringing regarding the good faith exception, and they consider it. The other thing I'm going to mention about the good faith exception and the argument that the government is making is that if you rely on a statute or if you rely in binding decisions, then you can apply a good faith exception. The problem we have with this argument in this case is that we have no evidence on the record about what the agent was relying on when he made the decision of ignoring the revocation to consent or disregarding or whatever word you want to use.
Is that subjective good faith required by law?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. But we can't. My point to that is that the judge would have to assume what he's relying on.
There would have to be some indication as to what they were relying upon in objective good faith, correct?
Correct. The standard this court has to apply today calls for more than a difference of opinion. The military judge action must be arbitrary, clearly unreasonable, clearly erroneous for this court to find an abuse of discretion. The judge applied the law as it stands correctly to the facts of this case. Therefore, this court should deny the government's appeal. The court has no further questions. I've concluded my argument.
No further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The United States has 3 points to make, but before I do, I want to point this court to U.S. v. Casio. Your review in this case, you review this issue de novo. It's a constitutional law issue. As a matter of law, does somebody have a privacy interest in a copy? But even if it was abuse of discretion, the government still wins because the military judge based his holding on erroneous conclusions of law. 3 points I want to hit. The first involves Deese. Judge Johnson, you just asked a few questions of appellee, and I want to build on those. Deese would apply in this case if appellee revoked consent and then OSI took his phone and plugged it into the machine, processed the information, and made copies. But that is not what happened here. What happened here was the appellee and OSI together, in phenomenal manner, in the interview room, going through the menu of the device, did the search and the copying in concert. So that distinguishes it from Deese completely. What appellee is asking you to do is go beyond Deese. By their argument that they made, they're saying that Brooks and Deese couldn't have even read the report had consent been revoked at, you know, later. That the machine would have done its job, and it doesn't matter whether the urine consent was revoked in that case, the urine was given back, whatever, that Brooks wouldn't have been able to read their own report, their own machine data, that there was a privacy interest to the product that the machine created. That is not what Deese says. Deese says the search would have ended the moment it goes to the lab. And that's all that Deese says. It doesn't say that once the machine's doing its processing, you know, that non-testimonial hearsay that this machine spits out, that there's a privacy interest in that in Deese. So appellee is asking you not only to misapply Deese, and the military judge misapplied the holding of Deese, but to go beyond Deese. Second, I want to extinguish outright this idea that Riley v. California applies to this case in any way. Riley v. California, the distinction that makes the difference in Riley v. California in this case is consent. That was a search incident to arrest. That was a warrantless, non-consensual search of somebody's property. And it was a balancing test. Chief Justice Roberts was giving. They were saying, look, the value of this property is so expansive and high that we have to have these added protections. That's a warrant would be even less, and a consent would arguably be even different. The value of the information that Justice Roberts talks about does not impact whether or not law enforcement meaningfully interfered with that information to the extent to make a seizure. There's no analogy there. The appellee consented to the data and, as the record reflects, knew very well what he was consenting to. They talked about the application data. They talked about multimedia. They talked about the music that would be copied. The fact he consented to this material, the fact that it had high value, in theory, is not relevant for purposes of this analysis. And finally, I want to touch on good faith. In this, the military judge erred because he said good faith could not apply. He said it could not apply. 311 doesn't permit it to apply. It's just it doesn't apply in this particular case. That is not the state of the law. The Davis case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, look, there are situations where we look to good faith. We look to see whether law enforcement was reasonably relying on the current state of the law. And the military judge erred when...
Isn't the requirement that there be binding precedent?
The government would argue that Hicks and Jacobs binds law enforcement and directs them to say, look, copying information is not a seizure. So operating under that good faith, there was no reason for law enforcement to believe that what they had in their possession belonged to appellee. And indeed, the record reflects that. His revocation of consent was a standard form letter. It didn't say, give me back that UFED data. They had no reason to believe that what they were doing was not in concert with Hicks or Jacobs. Now, if this court wants to do a new analysis and apply a new privacy interest on a copy outside of Hicks, outside of Jacobs, we would point this court to Peltier and Davis and say, look, at the time law enforcement agents in this case were doing it, they were relying on binding case law that said, look, copying information is not a seizure, and so therefore he didn't have a possessory interest in the copies, the data OSI was reviewing. And I see my time has run out. If I may briefly conclude, unless there are any questions.
No further questions.
Okay. Your Honor, may I brief conclude?
Yes.
Copying evidence is not a seizure of evidence. The search performed by OSI started and ended during the day of the interview. The military judge's opinion doesn't just stretch Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, it projects it beyond the horizon of the law. Appellee consented to the search. It was searched. What OSI does with that machine-generated data after the search was up to them. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll render our decision in due course. The court is now closed.